Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Paranormal Fringe. Only on the Vibe Network. Every Sunday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Where normal becomes paranormal. Here is your host, Rebecca.
Good evening and welcome to the Paranormal Fringe. Tonight we will be speaking with David Redfern. He's a well-known author of paranormal books, including Men in Black, which is what we will be discussing this evening. I'm going to go ahead and bring Nick on and introduce him to you guys. And then we're going to get started by asking him some questions, find out a little bit more about this phenomenon and what it's connected to. Hey, Nick, how are you tonight?
Hey, Rebecca. I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Doing great.
Good.
As I said, we're going to discuss those amazing Men in Black this evening and kind of get your expert opinion on what they are. Okay. Is it fact? Is it fiction? What's it tied to? And kind of go from there. What I'm going to do first is just let you go and introduce yourself, and then we'll get started with pummeling you with some questions.
All right. Well, I'm originally from England, live just outside Dallas, Texas, for about the last 16, 17 years, something like that. And I've got sort of an interest in various aspects of the paranormal, like UFOs, cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals, like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, and various aspects of the paranormal. I cover a wide range of different phenomena in terms of investigating various things and writing about them as well, really.
Right, and we love all of those things. So anything you want to talk about tonight, we are well open to hearing about.
All right.
We also have with us tonight, we have a couple of my co-hosts here. We have Dan Smuck, who is the lead investigator of Glass Paranormal, and also my normal co-host here, Ryan Nemec. And I'll go ahead and bring him on as well. Good evening, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
Good, thanks.
And as I said, we're going to start out discussing the Men in Black. And I know that Dan has some questions, and then we'll kind of just get started with that and see what Ryan has to add to the conversation.
Okay. Well, I mean, as far as the Men in Black mystery is concerned, Rebecca, you know, when you said at the beginning, you know, is it fact fiction? It's definitely not fiction that there is a real Men in Black phenomenon. But, of course, the big question is, what is it? Now, you know, most people's perceptions of who or what the Men in Black are probably come from the Men in Black movies, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. And in the movies, you know, the MIB work for this sort of like a super secret government agency that doesn't really answer to anybody and that is its own boss, and it's sort of hidden very deeply, and their job is to essentially bring to a halt like sort of a, you know, dangerous UFO activity on Earth. And of course they wear the black suits and the black glasses, etc., etc. Now, that is the sort of the public, popular culture image, if you like, of the Men in Black. And the movies themselves were based on a series of comic books that came out in the early 1990s, which followed the same trend, or started that same trend, of the MIB being government agents. But mm-hmm. If you speak to the witnesses who've seen the Men in Black, they tell a very different story. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Over about the last 12 or 13 years, I've written three books on the Men in Black mystery and one on the somewhat lesser known aspect of the Women in Black stories. And
oh,
I would say a good Yeah, yeah, there's quite a lot of really weird Women in Black stories as well. But what a lot of people don't realize until you speak to the witnesses is that the witnesses actually don't describe them as being anything like coming from the government. They're sort of typically described as being very pale and pasty looking. They wear these large wraparound sunglasses that hide the, or semi-hide, the sort of oversized bulging eyes they have. They have no wrinkles or lines on their face at all. And they still kind of dress, you know, like 1950s style with old style suits and black fedora hats. And I've got a lot of MIB reports which have nothing to do with UFO encounters, but where people have been using Ouija boards and it has sort of like opened a doorway, if you like, to allow these MIB through. In other cases, where the person had seen a UFO and the Men in Black had visited them and threatened them, and then afterwards they'd experienced violent poltergeist activity in the home. So there's a lot of sort of paranormal and supernatural overtones attached to the Men in Black. You know, it's actually nothing like, you know, the idea of somebody coming from a government agency and flashing an ID card and threatening people. It's far more sort of paranormal based than it is conspiracy based.
So do you feel these are possibly aliens then? Because that's kind of what it sounds like. Task force, police force kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there's two ways you can look at it. One is that they're either aliens, and that is one of the theories, that's one of the popular theories, because they do kind of look like semi-human and semi-alien in the sense that, as I said, they have this pale skin, they're sort of gaunt-looking, and they have large eyes. So they kind of look a little bit like this sort of the so-called alien greys. But if you imagine the greys crossed with a human, you know, you'd have something somewhere in between. And they admittedly do look a bit like that. But then other researchers have suggested, because you have these links with, like, Ouija boards and poltergeist activity, that some researchers have suggested that they're more sort of occult-based or supernatural-based, because you can find a number of crossovers between the Men in Black and various other paranormal phenomena. I mean, I'll give you one example, which I'm sure you heard of, the shadow people. Well,
right.
Within the sort of the phenomena of the shadow people, there's like one sub-category known as the Hat Man, which is like this shadowy, silhouetted figure that wears this old-style black hat. And then, you know, it is just like a silhouetted humanoid figure with a black hat on. But that is actually how many of the Men in Black are described. Apart from being sort of one-dimensional silhouetted, everything else about them is identical to the Hat Man, you know, like the suit, the hat, and the, you know, turning up in the dead of night or whatever. So, you know, you can either look at it, or there may be more than one explanation, but you can look at it from the perspective of alien, you know, extraterrestrial, or alien in the sense of something that's supernatural from some other kind of, like a different realm of existence rather than a different star system, you know.
Right, like they're just from a different dimension rather than from another star system, I get you.
Yeah, I kind of go more down the paranormal pathway, because, you know, when you read some of these stories, and they're so kind of creepy, where in some of the reports it's almost like they're like a modern day vampire, where I've got a lot of cases on record where people have had a paranormal experience and they get this weird knock on the door. Now, normally, you know, you wouldn't let people in the house at like 11 o'clock at night if you like a slow bang at the door and you look through the spire and there's these three creepy pale little guys, you wouldn't let them in. But people do let them in. People do let them in, though. And it's almost like they've been mind controlled to open the door. And when they do, and the MIB come in and threaten them, etc., the witnesses, excuse me, I've got a bit of a cough right now. The witnesses sometimes, they feel that they're being sort of drained of energy. They kind of feel weak, as if they're losing their strength, tired. And in some cases, they've gone like a diabetic, you know, who's missed a couple of meals, where they start to get cold and clammy and they get the shakes. And more than a few witnesses have actually said they felt that the men in black were there to essentially, like, feed on them. You know, that they were sort of living on our life force, and that was, you know, how they kind of keep themselves energized. They're almost like a psychic vampire type situation.
Okay, wow. So is this kind of along the same lines as the Black Eyed Children, which I heard is more or less a myth, but the Black Eyed Children?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of parallels between the Black Eyed Children and the Men in Black, and again, this is something I've written quite a bit about, because there are a lot of weird parallels. For example, just like the Men in Black, the Black Eyed Children, you know, they don't force themselves into people's homes. What they do, you know, they try and find a way to be invited in. And that kind of ties in with the old legends of vampires centuries ago. You know, in the old legends, the first time the vampire could enter your home is when it's invited. So I do actually sometimes wonder if these old, you know, centuries-old stories of vampires, you know, looking pale and dressed in black and coming out at night, were they real vampires, or could they have been early Men in Black reports and early Black-Eyed Children reports? Now, with the Black-Eyed Children, they seem to have this issue of, or skill, if you like, if that's the right word to use, to mind control people, where, you know, they try and find a way to get in. You know, can we come in? We need something to eat, or we're lost. Can we phone our parents? But it's always put in the in the position of the person that they're targeting. In other words, they have to have the final word to let them in. Otherwise, they cannot cross the threshold, so to speak. Now, the other parallels, of course, in a lot of the Men in Black stories, they're always dressed in black and they're pale. Well, in the Black Eyed Kids stories, typically they wear black hoodies and their skin's very pale.
Right.
Now, the big difference, of course, is the eyes in the Men in Black are typically much larger, but they look normal, just bigger. But with the Black Eyed Children, you know, hence the name, they're just sort of solid black. But, you know, if you look at the parallels, they're so close that, you know, it's clear to me at least that we're dealing with different aspects of the same phenomenon. And as I mentioned, there's also this category of the women in black, which I did a book on last year with the amazingly original title of Women in Black. And,
I like
and,
it.
Yeah, and that one, again, sort of demonstrated the angle of the Women in Black stories, where I've got a lot of reports from the 60s where, particularly in relation to UFO encounters, people were visited by these women dressed in black after they'd had a UFO encounter, and they claimed to be like census takers, or they were there to do a government survey or something like that. And they would just flash a card and let the people in. I mean, the people would let them in, and they just got this, people would get these strange vibes from them. You know, the questions would start out normal, and then they would ask, have you had any strange dreams or any weird experiences lately? And then the people are like, well, hang on, what's going on? And in many of these cases, the women were described as, you know, their skin was like white, like a sheet of paper. And in many cases, it was clear they were wearing long wigs, like in a bang style.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it covered all their sort of right down to their eyebrows and kind of, you know, folded in. And on top of that, they also wore the black sunglasses, so you barely could see their face. And again, there are a lot of weird stories where the women in black turned up in relation to not just UFO activity, but again, when the people have been perhaps involved in paranormal activity as well. So, you know, it takes it far beyond just the whole, you know, Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones angle.
Right.
I got a weird question. How did we come on?
How did we what?
How do you become like a man, like in the
He wants to know if there's a way that you can become an agent of the Men in Black, or is that something where they actually recruit based on the movie? Or?
Oh, Yeah, well, I don't think it's like that because, you know, we're not, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the most of the 95-96% of all the reports I get suggest these aren't human. So it's not like the movies, you know, where you get recruited or, you know, you get quietly asked to join or, you know, you apply for a job, you know. It actually isn't like that. It's, you know, a lot of people just don't realise that the movies, you know, the movie version of them being secret agents was specifically created for that, for those movies and based on the comic books that came out a few years earlier. But that was just based on the, you know, the approach that the writers wanted to take. But had they taken the, you know, the approach that most of the witnesses talk about, you know, we'd be looking at something more along the lines of, say, like in The Matrix, you know, where you have the agents in The Matrix where they're not real. You know, they're like,
right.
In the movie, you know, they're like part of this sophisticated program called The Matrix. And there's another film which really portrays the Men in Black really good, and they actually were, you know, they pulled the imagery from the real cases. That was from a film actually not too dissimilar to The Matrix, but which came out the previous year, called Dark City. If you ever see Dark City, that's like a really good film. It actually predates the Matrix, as I said, by 1 year. But it's kind of a similar thing where reality isn't what it seems to be. And they also have these Men in Black in the movie, but they're very different. If you look at the MIB in Dark City, that's the closest thing you'll probably see to the real Men in Black, where they kind of look like corpses, you know, that have been dead a day or two and that are still wandering around. You know, that's how they kind of look.
Oh. And as I said, I have Dan with me. Dan, did you have any questions for Nick?
Well, you know, I've read one account where they've actually been caught on a video in a hotel in Canada where an employee had seen a UFO, and then they come into the hotel looking for the employee to talk to him about the experience, and he's not actually there, but they end up talking to the other employees, you know, well, do you know where he is or what did he say about it and that kind of stuff. So, but they actually have, caught them on camera.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's an interesting piece of footage. You know, we know it wasn't hoaxed by anybody at the hotel or anything like that. It actually, you know, it was picked up legitimately on the cameras. But what's interesting, if you look at the two guys, they kind of have that same appearance that all the Men in Black have. They're just sort of like blank and, you know, vacant stares, almost like a zombified, emotionless appearance. And they look the same, and they look totally out of place, you know, because they're clothed. That's one of the weird things about the Men in Black. You would think they would want to kind of protect their identities, but by looking so weird, ironically, they actually stand out even more. People never forget the encounters because, you know, they look so weird, and they, you know, they dress in the old style fashion. So there's nothing really about them, but you know, that you can sort of tie in with the government, so to speak, really.
Right, you know, they're wearing the fedoras and the black suits and or even trench coats sometimes too, even in the middle of summer when it's 90 degrees out.
Yeah, and they even drive like old 1950s type.
Right.
Gangster cars, you know, like the shark fin tails on the trunk and whatever.
Yeah, 53 Cadillacs, you know.
So it's like everything about them is really weird. But there are a lot of strange things even with the cars where people have said the Men in Black kind of, you know, appeared. And then when they left, they saw this car outside and said the car and the Men in Black just vanished, almost as if it was like a hologram, you know, kind of like something out of the Matrix, you know, like a holographic
projection.
Didn't actually
drive away.
Yeah.
Didn't actually drive away, but just kind of just faded away. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very weird stuff like that. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting because this kind of suggests that whatever the Men in Black are, you know, because they're connected to the UFO phenomenon, it sort of then brings along the idea of, well, is the UFO phenomenon far more paranormal than it is extraterrestrial? I mean, if you look at the research of people like John Keel, who wrote The Mothman Prophecies, you know, when he first got into all this in the 1950s, he thought, you know, UFOs were alien spacecraft. But then when by the time he was sort of working in the 60s on things like Mothman and stuff like that, he came to believe that a lot of these phenomena seem to have a lot of parallels and crossovers, which they actually do. You know, like I said, with the Men in Black and the Hat Man and the Black Eyed Children, and then finding things like poltergeist activity in the home. And Keel found a lot of similarities between the activities of the Men in Black and sort of aspects of demonology as well. And he came to believe that all of these weird phenomena that are out there, whether it's UFOs, supernatural, Bigfoot, he came to believe that in one way or another, they're all sort of somehow interconnected.
Right. I mean, there's even been sightings of Men in Black in Loch Ness.
In where, sorry?
In Loch Ness, you know, where the Loch Ness Monster is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually mentioned that in one of my books. A really weird story, and it involves a guy named Ted Holliday. And Ted Holliday was someone who, at the start of the 1960s, he started to go up to Loch Ness every summer. He would take his vacation days off from work and go up there for about 10 days at a time and sort of like stake out the loch. And loch, for people who don't know, it's just a Scottish term for lake. It doesn't mean anything out of the ordinary. And so he'd go up to Loch Ness every summer and look for these creatures. Now, initially, he thought that, you know, like Bigfoot, Mothman, etc., he thought, you know, these are just unknown animals of a kind that we haven't found or classified yet. And he wrote a book called The Great Orm of Loch Ness, and Orm is an ancient Scottish term for like a supernatural creature. But the further that Ted Holliday dug into it, he started to get a lot of weird things happen to him. For example, on several occasions, he thought he saw these creatures like kind of surfacing out the water, and when he tried to photograph them, his camera would jam, the film would jam, or the pictures would come out fuzzy or blurred. And this kept happening to other researchers as well, and he started having weird synchronicities. And Ted Holliday eventually came round to the idea that these creatures in Loch Ness were far more supernatural entities than they were flesh and blood animals. Now, as far as the Men in Black case is concerned, in 1973, Ted Holliday had a weird experience where he was walking down to the shores of the loch, and he kind of had that feeling that we all get from one time to another where you think somebody's watching you. You know, you're sort of in the you're in the line at Walmart or somewhere, you know, and you just got this feeling someone's watching you. You turn around and somebody's eyes are just boring into you, you know. We all get that, but we don't know how it happens. Ted Holliday had that feeling. He turned round, and there was this guy just dressed totally in black. And Ted Holliday got this really kind of creepy, dangerous vibe coming from him. You know, that again, kind of feeling we all have for this, you know, at one time or another, where you meet someone for the first time, and for whatever reason, you just get a really bad vibe from them, but you don't know why. And Ted Holliday had that as well. And he had a feeling that this person or thing was not human, and he started to walk towards it. And then there was this sudden, like a swish or a whish of wind going past his ear. And as he sort of glanced around and then glanced back, the man had gone. Now, what makes it even more creepy is that the following year, and exactly 1 year to the day, because I said he took his same vacation days every year, he was struck down with a very serious heart attack at the exact spot where he saw the man in black the previous year. And he noted that in his kind of groggy, out of its state, when the ambulance guys were stretchering him up to the road at the top, he realized that the stretcher actually went over the patch of ground where the man in black was stood the year before. And a lot of researchers felt that Holliday had tapped into something sort of supernatural and evil rather than just an unknown animal. And he felt that the Men in Black had sort of given him a warning to leave it all alone or else. And he didn't leave it alone. And he actually had another heart attack and died at just the age of 59. And some researchers, this was in 1979 when he died, and some researchers to this day think, you know, it was all down to this this man in black encounter.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting story. it's just that, you know, it's more supernatural than you know, paranormal or a creature, you know, so.
Yeah, and there's a lot of weird stuff about Loch Ness. I mean, a lot of people don't know that back at the end of the 19th century, the famous occultist Aleister Crowley actually had a house on the shores of Loch Ness called Burleskin House, which burned down 2 years ago. And Crowley, while he was at Burleskin House, he was engaged in all sorts of supernatural rituals and rites to try and summon up supernatural entities from the loch. And people who visited Burleskin House got this sort of creepy, disturbing sense from it, you know, like a sense of foreboding. And two of the owners later years actually shot himself. One of them took an overdose. So a lot of weird stuff going on in Loch Ness. And as I said, there's the Man in Black encounter. And even some of the reports of the Loch Ness monsters are not all the same. You know, people think of like this humpback creature with a long neck, but other people have described something more like a huge frog. Others have said it looked like a big writhing worm. Some even said it looked more crocodile-like, which has given rise to the theory, if it is supernatural, it could be almost like a shapeshifter, you know, that it could actually alter its form, you know, according to, you know, like ancient legends of shapeshifters that you can find, you know, throughout all of history. So you put all that together at Loch Ness, you know, and you find it's not just your average lake with a couple of, you know, surviving relic pockets of colonies from the dinosaur era. You know, again, like with the Men in Black, the image, if you like, is far different to reality when we start digging into it all.
Now, have you heard of the Solway Firth spaceman?
Yes, yeah.
Now, this Jim Templeton, he took a picture of his daughter, and in the background was a picture of what looked like an astronaut almost.
Yeah.
And he states that after he took this picture, he was visited by the Men in Black. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Jim Templeton, a guy, took this picture in England in the 1960s. And it is a weird picture because you've got his daughter in the foreground and this, which, like you said, looks like a kind of, all, you know, vaguely like an astronaut suit behind it. But if you look at the picture, it's clearly not like a double exposure or anything like that. But the way the alien is standing, if you look at the slant of the ground, it's almost like he wouldn't be able to maintain that position. You know, you'd kind of fall over. So it's a very,
right.
You know, it's one of these pictures that is really weird, and you know, people still talk about that picture today. But yeah, he claimed that you know, he was visited by these two guys who claimed to be with the British Ministry of Defence, and instead of referring themselves with names, they used numbers.
Yeah.
And now in that case, this is where it gets a bit complicated. They may well have been from the government. And I'll explain what I mean that. Although the real Men in Black are clearly not from the government, what I think has happened on occasion is that the government realizes that this weirder paranormal MIB phenomenon exists. And I think on occasion, not very often, but I think on occasion, they've actually used the MIB legend as a cover for their own activities. So there may actually be examples where government people have gone out and dressed in black suits when they want to silence and threaten UFO witnesses, but they're not the real Men in Black. What they're doing is mimicking the real Men in Black as a means to protect their real identity and camouflage who they really are. So in other words, it gets kind of confusing and controversial where you have possibly the real phenomenon and then you have a smaller category of government people acting as the MIB.
Just feeding off that legend, basically.
Yeah, and because it acts as a good camouflage for them. You know, if they want to silence someone, they'll, you know, it's like, well, guys, you know, get the black suit on and the black hat and we'll get around and see Mrs. Smith and, you know, we'll put the fear of God in her. And that's all they need to do. And what they're doing, as I said, they're not the real Men in Black. They may not even know who or what the real MIB are, but they understand that if they dress like them and act like them, it'll still get the message across, you know.
Right.
Right.
But
yeah.
But go ahead, Dan.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you know, it's like there have been other times where they've either been reading a book about UFOs or just basically researching the project, and these men in black show up and ask them questions about their research, or tell them, okay, you need to stop doing your research, or, you know, you're reading that book. Are you really interested in it? You know, it's kind of, you know, with your doing, writing your books, have you ever experienced anything like that?
I haven't, but I mean, that's a good point you bring up. I'll tell you for why, because the kind of cases you're talking about where people have been warned off doing this or doing that, in many cases, you know, they've kept their research to themselves. They haven't told anybody what they're doing, and yet the men in black turn up on their door, you know, and nobody really understands how they're able to do that, you know, or sometimes they've had a UFO encounter and not told anyone, but the MIB still know. But I've never had, you know, a knock on the door or anything like that. But what I have had is another aspect of the Men in Black mysteries, which is weird telephone calls. Now, a lot of people who've had visits from the Men in Black, in the immediate days afterwards, they've reported sort of hang-up calls in the middle of the night, or, you know, the phone will ring out and it'll say private caller or unknown caller, and sometimes they pick it up, there's like weird static on the line, or sometimes it's outright threats from people, or a voice at least. Now, I've never had the threats, but I have had sort of the, you know, early hours of the morning calls. I've also had, like, the weird static calls. And on several occasions, which gets into really strange categories, one of these early hours calls, like 3 in the morning, you know, because who's calling, you know, who the hell's calling this time of the night? You think it's bad news,
right,
you know, if it's like 3 in the morning. So I actually did get up and I came into the living room and looked at the phone, and the caller ID was actually my own phone, which was like bizarre. Yeah. This was actually at the height of doing an MIB investigation. So I think a lot of this, you know, again, could be paranormal, but it's been because, you know, there are a lot of examples where supernatural activity interacts, you know, with electrical equipment. I mean, I'm sure you know this, but, you know, people who go out on, like, ghost hunts, that kind of thing, sometimes their, you know, their detection equipment plays up and goes wrong. And, you know, I think there's I think there's good evidence that supernatural phenomena can kind of get its grips into electrical equipment and things like that. So the idea that they would be able to manipulate our phones, etc., considering what else they can do, you know, doesn't really sound, you know, too wide of the mark.
No, it doesn't.
There was something else that I ran across, and if you're not familiar with this, I apologize, but back in, like, January of 2002, American actor named Dan Aykroyd sold a series to the Sci-Fi Channel called Out There, which was a kind of a groundbreaking UFO crop circle alien abduction show. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I have, actually. I mean, a lot of people don't know that Dan Aykroyd, the actor, you know, he actually has a deep and serious interest in UFOs. You know, it's not sort of entertainment for him. You know, he has a legitimate fascination with the phenomenon. And, yeah, he had this sort of, you know, this weird kind of classic scenario of, you know, when somebody gets too close to the truth or they're doing something that might bring more attention to what's going on. You know, he got the kind of same thing, you know, this it'd be good to leave, you know, be good to leave it alone, that kind of thing. That's typically what they, you know, they kind of say. It's like a veiled threat, you know, rather than, you know, you'll die if you don't stop this. It's more, you know, we can make things very difficult, or, you know, one guy, for example, Herbert Hopkins, who had an MIB encounter in 1976. The MIB took a coin and dematerialized it from his hand and said, "I can do the same to your heart." And his man in black was like totally creepy. I mean, his MIB really did look like one of the Walking Dead. I mean, it looked like a dead person, you know, reanimated and jerky and, you know, just really weird.
Yeah, that was one of the things that people... Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I read that about that story, and it was like towards the end too. After he did the coin disappearing, he started to sound like he was running out of energy, and he was very choppy with his speech. And then he got out very feebly, and kind of almost fell down the stairs as he was leaving the building. So,
well, yeah, that kind of gets back to what I said about, you know, them, where people have said they felt they were feeding on their energy, you know, as if they, rather than eat food and drink liquid or whatever, that the men in black, one of the reasons they target us is because they literally feed on us, you know. And which would be kind of, you know, disturbing if that is the case. But then I guess if you think about it, you know, everything feeds on something, you know, to stay alive. So maybe that's their way of doing it.
Yeah, why not?
There's also,
why couldn't they feed on energy, you know, so
rather than
actual food.
It's like recharging a battery, you know, it's not food, but it's energy, and the battery still lives, if you like, in its own way, you know what I mean?
That ties back into the black-eyed children that people have had encounters with, so they almost acted like they wanted to steal their life force. I mean, that they were that afraid, they, you know, that panic that you get, like, you know, you're not safe. Something bad's going to happen to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at the black-eyed children ones, several times, you know, they've said they need food. And, you know, with hindsight, I've kind of wondered with some of these cases, if when they're talking about food, they're not actually talking about the kind of food we would think of. You know, they may actually be thinking of an energy-type food.
Yeah, they don't want us to take them to McDonald's.
No, I don't think McDonald's is their idea of food. But, yeah, I think, you know, we could be looking at something along those lines. I mean, you can find things throughout history, you know, like tales of vampires. You know, if you go back to, like, creatures like incubus and succubus, you know, these sort of paranormal, like sexual paranormal predators that would not just have, you know, sex with people in the middle of the night, but they would literally drain them of their life force as well. You know, like a parasite. So you can find these kind of parallels, you know, going back to like ancient Babylonia, you know, Mesopotamia thousands of years ago, when they were talking about things like Lilith, you know, this sort of prototype succubus type creature. And, you know, right up till the present day, people still have these experiences. I mean, in Newfoundland, for example, there's the phenomenon of the old hag, like this old lady who straddles people in the middle of the night and, again, you know, drains them of their energy and has sex with them. And, you know, they haven't changed that much over the centuries or the millennia even. And, you know, as I said, you can find parallels with the women in black, the men in black, and the black-eyed kids, you know. So and you put all that together with the Hat Man and the Shadow People. I think it's all somehow interconnected.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like that it's all somehow interconnected, yeah.
Well, another one that's connected, and this is a book I have coming out in February, so not too far away now, is a book, actually the first full-length non-fiction book, on the Slender Man phenomenon. Now, you know, the Slender Man started off as an internet meme. You know, it was like a cool, creepy creation for the internet, for this website called Something Awful that this guy, Eric Knudsen, created. You know, and he took various imagery from, you know, the Men in Black and paranormal entities and the work of people like H.P. Lovecraft and came up with this Slender Man, you know, like this pale-faced creature with a black suit and tie. You know, it kind of looks like a bit like a man in black, but more spindly and spidery. But now, in today's world, people see the Slender Man, and it's, you know, for me, this sort of ties in with a phenomenon that interests me a lot, the phenomenon of tulpas, where if enough people think about something, you can create like a real world version of the fictional thing that you're thinking about. You know, all it requires is enough intense concentration, and it kind of, the brain or the imagination externalizes the image and creates a real version. And I think that's why people are now seeing the Slender Man. It's not down to bad dreams. It's down to the fascination that millions of people have, and it is millions, you know, in the phenomenon of the Slender Man, to the point where now it exists. And again, you know, the theme of the tulpa is to keep alive, to stay alive. The tulpa has to sort of nurture and feed on our beliefs. So it doesn't feed on energy or food, but it requires us to continue to believe in it to allow it to exist. So in its own strange way, you know, it kind of feeds on us, but it feeds on our belief in the creature.
Yeah, there was actually, we did a show on Slender Man some, you know, a couple episodes ago, and there was actually a couple of girls that attempted murder in order to appease Slender Man, and you know, they swore up and down that they had seen him, and that he was after their families, and if they did not do what he had asked of them, that he would come and kill their families, which it's fascinating to me that this whole phenomenon is created. It's like you said, we kind of wished it, or the fear of it made it come into existence.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's kind of one of those situations, you know, like be careful what you ask for, you know, because you can find a lot of examples of what are known as tulpas throughout history where, you know, I really do believe this is a genuine phenomenon where if you... you know, get yourself into a sort of meditative state, you know, even an altered state, and focus on one particular image, and you focus on it, and you focus on it, and you project it, and you think about it, that you can kind of will it into existence, not to where it's like a physical, fully formed 3D entity, but it kind of looks like that to the point where, you know, it becomes, for all intents and purposes, a real-world equivalent, you know. And, of course, the danger is that when these creatures come to life, you know, in terms of what their life is, a strange form of life, they want to hang on to it, and they become very rebellious and dangerous and will do anything and everything to hang on to that life that they've been given, even if they don't fully understand what they are. You know, they're determined to keep what they've got, and sometimes it sort of ends up turning the tables on the creator. You know, they become the victim, and the tulpa becomes the sort of victor.
Now, do you feel that shadow people are the same kind of entity then?
Well, I'm always sort of kind of loath to sort of put everything just down to one explanation. I think there could be, like with the Men in Black, I think there could be several explanations. Now, I think, you know, with the shadow people, there's no doubt there's a phenomenon. And like with the Black Eyed Children and the Slender Man, there's no doubt that the shadow people phenomenon has risen massively in terms of numbers in the last few years. So, again, I think
Absolutely. We
could be dealing with a real phenomenon of shadow people, but the more that people hear about it and focus on it, it could be that they've also created a tulpa version of the shadow people. So there might be, again, sort of different answers for different types of shadow people encounters, I think.
Right, and there's also mention of this phenomenon declining since the original, you know, 15 years ago when the original MIB was released. And I know you dispute that notion, the sightings have declined, correct?
Of the what, sorry?
That some people are saying that the sightings of the Men in Black have decreased, but I've read that you disagree with that you don't think it has.
So you broke up. I didn't get that question. You broke up again then, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that better?
That's better now, yeah. What was the question again?
There are disputes that the Men in Black phenomenon is declining. Do you agree with that?
Oh, declining. Oh, okay. No, I mean, I could understand why that might be the case, because I guess, you know, a lot of people just don't hear about reports. But, you know, it's kind of like with me, having written 3 on the Men in Black and 1 on the Women in Black, I get a lot of feedback from people who have seen, encountered the MIB. Now, I probably get, I would say, 4, 5, 6 cases a month. Now, in the same way, you know, somebody who writes books on crop circles probably gets a lot of reports mm-hmm. on crop circles, you know, and same with alien abduction books, that kind of thing. So for
right.
me, I get a lot of these reports, and I would say at least 3/4 of the reports that I get are from people who've had experiences in the last 4 or 5 years. I still get mm-hmm. some, you know, where people haven't spoken out since the 60s or the 70s. But for the most part, the ones I get today are from, you know, the last 5, 10, 15 years. And but the weird thing is, they still look the same, you know, the skinny black tie, the suit, the fedora, the pale skin, the glasses. But I think the problem is that, you know, a lot of people just publicly don't want to talk about this because people think they're crazy, you know. They say, oh, you've been watching too many movies, you know.
right.
And that's actually what I found in some cases. They're like, oh, I just thought the Men in Black were from the movies, and I wanted to share the story, but please don't ever publish my name, you know, because people can think I'm mad. That's kind of the response I get.
Right.
But the fact yeah. is, you know, that these sightings are still going on, and it's really dependent on, you know, the witness or not the witness, you know, to come forward or come forward publicly at least. So, but yeah, I can see why people, like I said, I can see why people do think it's declining if you don't see too many. But, you know, everyone I get, providing I get permission, of course, from the person, you know, I'll put it out there for everybody to see.
Now, Nick, what is your favorite? Oh, I was just going to say, what's your favorite Men in Black story that you encountered?
Well, actually, I wouldn't necessarily say it's one of the Men in Black stories. I'd say it's probably more the Women in Black, one of the Women in Black stories. There's a lot of Women in Black stories out there. And one of the ones that's kind of really intriguing is a case where back in the early 1930s, a young boy in West Virginia had a series of encounters in the middle of the night where this sort of woman dressed in black would come into the bedroom and kind of glide across the room, and this little boy had around his neck a chain with a coin on it. And, you know, we brought up coins before. Oh. Coins actually turn up in a lot of Men in Black and Women in Black cases. But in this case, the boy would wake up every night with this woman in black tugging on the coin, on this chain, and his parents thought, you know, just a bad dream. This went on for like 4 or 5 nights, and on the next night, they stayed in the room with him and actually saw this woman kind of glide through the wall, literally through the wall. And she had sort of like a long black outfit, long black hair, white skin. And just as she was about to grab the coin, they put the light on, and she sort of literally kind of hissed at them and then vanished. Now, what's interesting...
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, what's interesting about this is that the little boy was the cousin of a man named Albert Bender. And Albert Bender was the man who, in the early 50s, actually began the Men in Black mystery when he was visited by 3MIB after getting too close to the truth about UFOs. And Bender's MIB were described as... like semi-physical, in the sense that they could walk through walls and doors, and they had like these sort of bright shining eyes, and they sound more like the Hat Man than the traditional image of, you know, the Men in Black. But that's interesting, mm-hmm. you know, that the guy who kicked off the Men in Black mystery in the early 50s with the first stories had a cousin who had been visited by this creepy woman in black trying to steal his coin. And I think I've got 5 coin-related stories concerning the Men in Black, where they were either trying to steal them, or they were dematerializing them, or transforming them into like a different substance, even like alchemy, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Did you have a question, Dan?
Yeah. How do you get your case? How did these cases come to you?
Well, excuse me. I think it's like a lot of people. You know, if you write about Roswell or you write about Area 51 and somebody knows about it, I think they kind of just, you know, seek out people in that field. I mean, I would say the vast majority of all the cases I get, nearly all of them, come from people approaching me rather than me just stumbling on the story. You know, it'll be, oh, I urge, you know, I mean, the classic thing would be like, you know, I was listening on Rebecca's show tonight and, you know, tomorrow morning somebody who's listening to the show will have sent me a Facebook message. But that's usually how it happens. You know, somebody either emails me, Facebooks me, after they've either read an article I've written or a book I've written, or if they've heard me on a radio show talking about it, and they'll contact me, and then I'll get back in touch. And that really is how it's, you know, it is that simple, really, for most cases.
Okay, yeah. But I find it funny, though, that, you know, these men in black show up to, hey, you better not talk about this or else, but then people end up talking about it anyway.
Yeah, well, that is the weird thing, because they're so weird and so memorable that people very often just can't help talking about it. But there typically isn't like a follow-up visit. It's usually just that one. I said there's sometimes phone interference and weird stuff on the phones, but for the most part, it actually is just the first threat. But what I would say, you know, some people have suggested that the threat is just the ruse to frighten people. And then, as I said earlier, that they then, when a person's in a high state of emotion, then they feed on that emotion and that
right.
energy. So maybe that's the actual goal, is not to actually, you know, terrify them into not talking about them. It's just to terrify them, period, so they can then just grab that energy, so to speak.
Right. Okay, yeah. I mean, there has been some instances where there's been a second visit, like, you know, 67,
yeah.
when he hit the object and a piece of metal was in his grill, and they showed up, and it was after he sent it off, and they're like, you better get it back. And, you know, they came back to, did you get it back yet? And, you know, if you don't, we're going to harm your wife. And then they never showed up again. So,
yeah, there's a few like that. I mean, the Herbert Hopkins one I mentioned earlier, you know, this doctor in 1976 had this, you know, he had this creepy old MIB character dematerialized his coin and said he could do the same to Hopkins' heart. Now,
right.
Hopkins' son and wife, they got a visit as well from this sort of creepy guy and this creepy woman. And there have all been all sorts of theories as to who they were. You know, they didn't seem like normal people if you actually read the original story. But somebody kind of debunked it and said, oh, they're part of a swingers group, which was kind of like an interesting alternative theory, you know, on who they actually
right,
were.
Yeah.
But if you read the original story, you know, actually they kind of sound just like the Men in Black and the Women in Black. They sort of, you know, their skin texture was odd, and even sort of their length of their arms, their bones, like the elbow ratio to the wrist and everything, was described as being different. You know, they just didn't seem like normal people.
Right, and then and their voices are more mechanical or...
Yeah, that's right, almost robotic in some cases.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
So kind of close
yeah,
to almost like you mentioned a hologram.
Well, that's in some cases people have suggested that the idea that some sort of phenomenon mind controls the person and they are sort of plunged into or exposed to like a holographic event in their room where if anybody else was watching it, they would see the person in a trance but not see anything else at all. Everything else would look normal except there being like this weird frozen trance. And, you know, the idea that it could be, you know, that instead of sending out literal physical men in black, maybe what they're sending out is like a highly sophisticated computer program, which instead of downloading it to your laptop or whatever, it's downloaded into our reality, literally, you know, into your room. So, you know, and it looks so real and genuine that the person thinks they're seeing, you know, the men in black when it is almost like a dreamlike holographic state. That might explain how they can vanish and appear so quickly, why the cars vanish,
right.
because they may not
yeah.
be real in the sense that we understand real, but they could be real in some sort of like a holographic kind of state.
Right. You know,
amazing.
I remember reading a story that, you know, the guy got a phone call, you're doing research on UFOs, I'd like to come and talk to you about it. And he's like, well, sure. And he goes to turn on the porch light, and the guy's already standing there.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that was a Herbert
yeah.
Hopkins one.
Wow.
Yeah. But there's a few like that where they just, people, sometimes there have been cases where they've been thinking about them, You know, Albert Bender had several encounters with them, and on one occasion when he thought about them, they literally came through his walls again, as if, you know, as if they knew it when he was thinking about them. And that's something that crops up in a number of cases where it's almost like when you think about the Men in Black, that it's like something tips their radar, so to speak, and they then turn the tables on you. They know when you're sort of looking at them or looking for them.
Right.
We won't get any visits from them tonight after the show.
Yeah, try not to think about it. It's actually not the easiest thing to do, not to think about it.
No.
Right.
Exactly. But, Nick, we'd like to thank you for being on the Paranormal Fringe tonight. We'd like to give you an opportunity here to kind of let people know where they can get your books, how they can contact you, and if you've got any conferences or events coming up, they can get in touch with you.
Okay. Well, all my books are available on Amazon, and about 60% of them you can get off the shelves in Barnes & Noble. And I'm actually speaking at a conference next weekend. It's the New England UFO Conference. If you just look up New England UFO Conference, you'll find it. On the Friday night, this coming Friday night, I'll be speaking on the Women in Black mystery. And then on Saturday, I'll actually be talking about shapeshifters and bringing into the lecture the issue of the black-eyed children and the men in black. So that'll be this coming weekend.
Awesome. And they can reach you also. They can reach you through Facebook Messenger,
people
correct?
Can, I have a blog called World of Whatever. If you type in Nick Redfern, World of Whatever, you'll find my blog and you can contact me there, or you can also contact me at Facebook as well. And, you know, I was always happy to answer questions, or, you know, people got cases they want to share, they can always reach me at Facebook Message.
Awesome. And we will put all your information up on the Paranormal Fringe page after the show. And again, thank you for joining us.
We'll talk
to you again.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank
you. Thank you. Have a great evening, Nick.
All right, you too. See you later.
And that wraps up another episode of the Paranormal Fringe. We will be back next week with an exciting new topic, exciting new guest. We hope you guys have a great evening, and thank you for joining the Fringe.